from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the third segment in a series of discussions about contemporary American religious thought and practice. What's to be made of the interplay between religion and politics in American society today? What are the ways and means available to politically active religious groups? The panelists in the following portion of the conversation are Marjorie Heyer, Martin Marty, James English, Mark Taylor, and Harmon Smith. Marjorie Heyer is religion editor for The Washington Post. Martin Marty is a professor of history at the University of Chicago Divinity School and co-editor of the journal Christian Century. Father James English is a Jesuit priest at the Leesville Road Parish in Raleigh, North Carolina. Mark Taylor and Harmon Smith recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Professor Taylor teaches in the Department of Religion at Williams College, and Professor Smith in the Divinity School at Duke University. The conversation begins with comments from Marjorie Heyer about the goals of politically active American churches.
In some cases it's legislation, in some cases it's specific legislation that will very directly benefit them. In other cases, it's they're seeking to use the legislative route to further their views of what to do their missionary work, to do their evangelistic work. The whole issue of school prayer is a case in point. You talk to somebody who's in favor of school prayer and tell them, well, kid can pray in school, or why don't you have prayer in the home? Why don't you do take care of the prayer requirements that way? And they come at you with the argument that, but it's the other children who don't, the children who don't come from a religious home. Or they use the argument that school prayer is a way to reduce juvenile delinquency. It's certainly one of the objectives of churches in involvement in politics is to further their own religious beliefs and expand the religious community in that through that method.
C.S. Lewis once said, if you don't know history, you're likely to know recent bad history. And recent bad history says that religion can truly stay out of it. I don't think there is such a possibility in a political society of having any large corporate body be non-political. It's a very heavy political decision of a society to say we will not tax church property. That's accepting that is a political engagement. Negatively speaking, not to take a stand is to take a stand. When I read today the books on the rise of Nazism, I find that the Lutherans and to some extent the Catholics of Germany who didn't take a stand against Hitler were always counted by him and for him. And I think what we're seeing in America today is a more frank recognition of this by the groups that used to be seen as passive, who realize they have to get back in the fray, and because they are now prosperous and powerful, are doing so with more zest than a lot of people before. That doesn't solve things to say that. We're back to Marjorie Heyer's theme, and that is what instrument should we use? If it's an attempt to take my particular views, which I can't even convince my own members about, and try to coerce society to it, I'm likely to get frustrated. Society won't do that. If I say that many things that the church is interested in, care of the earth is on page one of Genesis, and so I get involved in environmental and ecological battles, or care of the poor in a complex world, I'd better know that every stand I take is going to inconvenience somebody, and therefore there'll be opposition too. So do you do it through pronouncements, task forces, workforces, demonstrations, individuals? That's all very risky and chancy. The only point I'd like to defend now is the re-intrusion of fundamentalists and Catholic bishops and so on into the overt political order is precisely that. It's a re-intrusion. They're coming back to where they were until the recent past.
Let me ask Jim English to comment. How are your parishioners looking at the statements coming from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops about nuclear U.S. nuclear policy?
One hesitates to answer for one's parishioners, but I will try. I would say that we're very glad that Roman Catholicism right now is increasingly, in the person of its bishops, involving itself with the major questions, political questions, that confront the country and us as citizens. I think that's a necessary step for us to take. It's a step away from where we were, which was either total agreement or total silence to prove that we were good Americans. I think as we do that, we also know that there's a long learning experience there, and that the beginning of the dialogue with this country politically does not mean any present expertise. And therefore, as we, I think, take delight in seeing the bishops begin to address these questions, I don't know that we're going to presume their expertise in something as complex for all of us and as arcane as nuclear policy. So I think we're glad to see the dialogue begin, but we're going to weigh it very carefully in terms of the other sides of the dialogue that are occurring in the country. To your question about the Catholic population, one can say yes and no, very much so, not much at all. It's such a complex group of people and it exists at so many levels that I think any degree of knowledgeability or lack of knowledgeability exists somewhere massively in the Catholic population right now.
One of the things that interests me about this whole effort of the bishops and their state policy statement on nuclear warfare is the attempts that many of the bishops have made to educate their people. In Washington, for instance, the Archbishop of Washington started out with his own pastoral letter, a statement more than, well, about a year ago, with 2 days of seminars for the priests, for every priest in the archdiocese, a day-long convocation last September to which more than 1,000 people came on one of the nicest Saturdays in September, and continuing efforts of that sort in local parishes throughout the archdiocese. And at the bishops' conference later in November, many of the other bishops indicated the same kinds of process were going on in their dioceses. Not only within the Catholic Church, one bishop spoke of having a, this was a man from the Midwest where there were a fair number of Protestants as well as Catholics in an area, who spoke of having dialogues and seminars and programs involving people of other churches, and made the comment that, another bishop made the comment that the bishop's involvement with this issue was beginning to be seen by some of the fallen away Catholics as an indication of a church that they wanted to come back and have something to do with again.
And yet one of the paradoxes in Catholicism today seems to me, as an outside observer, to be the presence of a leader in the person of the Pope of enormous political power in certain ways, who nonetheless, doctrinally, has such profound reservations about overt political involvement on the part of the priesthood, as instance, for example, in the kinds of reservations he's expressed in terms of political involvement for priests in Latin America. How does one respond to that kind of ambiguity, or perhaps it's not such from another angle?
As a Catholic priest, I would simply say that I absolutely acknowledge the ambiguity. He is one of the most politically powerful and active popes I think we've had, and at the same time is a pope who wants no one else in the church to become as politically activated as he himself is. So I find that an ambiguous situation in the church right now.
I remember seeing a cartoon a couple of years ago of the Pope writing, "Dear Father Dryan, and all priests must stay out of politics," and over his shoulder, his secretary is saying, "Now you're scheduled for today. At 10:30, you meet someone from the PLO. At 11:10, we have to send the draft of your UN speech over." And he went through the day, and there were 10 or 12 priestly political engagements. And with Father English, I would have to say, too, there's a lot of ambiguity in that.
I think it should be pointed out that it did not originate with Pope John Paul, the idea that priests should not participate in partisan politics. The canon was on, has been on the books for a good many years. He simply called in the markers on it. As I understand it, the canon requires that priests, and now sisters as well, not participate in partisan politics without the special permission of their superiors, which Dryden had, but which was revoked then at the behest of the present pope.
I think something of his mindset was made clear during his first trip to South America, which was such a delicate situation. And when he went down, I think everyone in South America had a different expectation of what he would do. And he satisfied none of the expectations. And if I recall correctly, what he really said to South America was, "We will not take the part of any political party. We demand the prophetic role of standing outside of political parties and judging all political parties. At the moment you become attached to one, you are no longer in the prophetic role. You're pushing a particular political situation." And I think he's trying to make the church in general do that, to assume the prophetic role outside of actually connecting with a particular viewpoint or a particular theory. Whether he does that himself or not, I don't know. I think sometimes he does, and sometimes he might cross a line that he would take objection to in others.
Isn't it true that what we're talking about is not whether religion gets engaged in politics or religious bodies get engaged in politics, but the appropriate ways? It seems to me not a question of whether they're going to do that, and you don't even have to raise the issue of joint citizenship in two kingdoms in order to get at that in this country. Given the structure of politics in America, the only possible way to represent a point of view is to gain sufficient power in the political arena to get that point of view represented. And at a gross level, what that eventually comes to in a democratic process is that might makes right. The difficulty occurs in that some of those decisions, which appear politically to be fairly benign, are all the same going to affect very deeply the consciences of some religious people. So the Supreme Court's decision about abortion did not mandate that women had to receive abortions. As a matter of fact, there are a number of lacuna in the decision itself, it seems to me. But just for the sake of this argument, you can say it is a permissive ruling. It simply allows that to be done. But there are some people who feel so strongly that even if it is permitted, it violates certain basic notions that they have about who we are and how we're put together and so on, that is destructive of the kind of society we're in. And even if it doesn't offend those who take advantage of the permissibility of it, it ought to be restricted or even prohibited. And when you get that kind of standoff in a society like ours, there doesn't seem to be any remedy at all, since there is no telos to which this society consensually points, except freedom for, I think, its own sake. One of the things that has happened in the postmodern world is that freedom is no longer an ends to a means. Freedom, qua freedom, is its own end. And that means now then that virtually everything morally is up for grabs, and the only way to get your point of view into the picture is to organize, secure the money, the power necessary in the system to get that expressed. I would think that what the Pope has said and what some other churches have adopted as a position is not having to do with whether religionists get involved in politics, but how they do that and whether various means to that end are appropriate.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the third segment in a series of discussions about contemporary American religious thought and practice. The panelists in the following portion of the conversation are Martin Marty, James English, and Harmon Smith. Martin Marty teaches in the Divinity School at the University of Chicago and is the co-editor of the journal Christian Century. James English is a Jesuit priest at the Leesville Road Parish in Raleigh, North Carolina. Harmon Smith is a professor in the Divinity School at Duke University. He recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about the development of autonomous moral authority in American Christianity. Here is Martin Marty.
I think we do live on two levels here, and Harmon Smith, I think you're pointing to an important distinction here. I don't think we have to say that all entrances of religious voices into the public order are immediately political in the partisan sense and mere assertions of power, though it will often come to that. I'd like to make a distinction between that dimension of politics which seeks the public good by minimizing the violence that would be present if you didn't have a political order. If we'd be Lebanon with guns, we happen to have a political order where we have instruments by which the ballot box settles things, and you can get a coalition of pro or anti-abortionists to put something on the law books that a large minority of less organized people may not agree with. That's what you're describing quite properly as a mere assertion of power. Since we can't agree on final ends, let's get 51% and we'll get there. The issue you took, abortion, is probably the most difficult of all these ethical issues, because it's the one that, in the conscience of many millions of Americans, is an ultimate issue that is not simply a crime, a sin, but a crime as well. If you took something else, like whether there's school prayer or not, they may organize for power, but if they don't get school prayer, they can sleep at night. Many a conscience of an anti-abortionist is so quickened on this point that they really have trouble sleeping because they think our society legitimates murder. So maybe we should back off from that one, though even that one I think can be aided some on the second level, and that's what I would just call public discourse, not power politics. A public discourse is persuasive and allows for certain things to happen in the private realm. Since I've already said can't do too much with abortion, let me say two things I could picture happening. At present, we don't have public discourse because we don't, as you say, have a goal, a telos, a common language on which to agree, or, I think I'd put it, we have more than we're using. But once things get on a bumper sticker, it all ends. And if you have two bumper stickers, one that says abortion is murder, and the other that says a woman's body is her own to do with what she wants, both of these are conclusions drawn from complex histories. I can't find the former anywhere in Catholic discourse in all history until the last 15 years, and I don't know many women who really believe their body is their own to do with what they want. They usually say they belong to nature and a community and a family and other people. What you'd need is someone to come along and say, for example, a formula. We should have Jim English's hero, John Courtney Murray, here to invent some, but let me try. The fetus has rights, but the fetus alone does not have all the rights. It's something that is widely believed in the society by the people who put on bumper stickers, and you could have some measure of bartering and discussion if you could get people even that far. But we're so polarized, we don't. Moving to the other level of public discourse and persuasion, I read recently of a nun who said, I'm not interested in making abortion illegal. I'm interested in making it unthinkable. And I think that this is probably the place where the religious groups have often fallen down. I knew a young woman who worked in an abortion clinic in a Midwestern city. And I said, that must be depressing, working with these poor ghetto people, unrelated to anybody. And she said, we're a for-profit place, and I never meet a young woman who isn't a graduate of, and she listed 10 colleges, including Catholic and Evangelical. And she later sent me a printout of the religions of the young women who came in there. It was almost an exact match of the religions of the area. If your community is 3% Jewish, 3% of the abortions are Jewish. If you're 38% Catholic, 38% of the abortions are Catholic. If you're 12% Methodist, 12% of the abortions are Methodist. In other words, we have not done well with discourse in convincing in our own circles, and therefore we often resort to the public order to do this kind of coercing. And I would love to see both of these vivified. Bring back some common terms that are latent in our discussion, we could get somewhere, and do more convincing instead of losing the argument and trying to resort to law.
It would seem to me, too, that in this discussion, you can think of it on a worldwide basis where you have very, very different forms of government, and just our own national experience, where it seems to me it's far more possible for religious voices to take part in national dialogue because we do create the kind of freedom for every expression to be made. Therefore, if my expression is persuasive and I'm allowed to make it, really the country has done for me what the country has promised to do for me. It hasn't promised that the majority will agree with me.
I think all of you are a little more optimistic than I am about the capabilities of the political process in this society. I don't think we have a rational method, as Alistair MacIntyre has argued. I don't think we have a rational method in this society by which we can resolve these fundamental moral quandaries that confront us. Abortion is an obvious instance, school prayer, the nuclear freeze, all of the big questions that confront us. And the reason that we don't have a rational method is that we do not agree upon the predicates of the argument. We don't agree upon the ends of the argument, what they are directed toward. And I'm much less sanguine, if I understand Marty correctly, about the capacity of the society reasonably to argue out these various positions and, Jim, to be persuaded by the force of the argument. My impression is that what happens is more often, indeed almost to the exclusion of everything else, is that if you have enough money to support a powerful enough lobby, then you will get what you want in Washington. I think that is clearly the point of view that Jerry Falwell and the so-called moral majority and others in the evangelical camp have adopted. They know that short of securing and then exercising that kind of power, they're not going to be heard in this society. And I think it is deceptive. I think it's finally unproductive to suppose that given the pluralism of the society, which is just rampant, and all of the centrifugal forces that are operative in the society, that we can anticipate the rational resolution of problems of this sort. Now, are you going to tell me I'm a cynic, Marty?
No, you aren't a cynic at all, and I certainly share that vision to a large extent. There are a few cautionary words I'd put upon it. I sometimes think that we presume there was more concord in the past than there was. But if you read the political debates of parliaments when all English were Anglican, or early America when everyone was somehow Protestant, they differed almost as much as we do now. And the winning voice often got by simply by the suppression of the alternatives. I think of the first UN ambassador, Warren Austin, who once heard an intense debate between an Arab and a Jew and said, "Now, I think we could settle this if you just come out in the hall with me and we talk this over like Christian gentlemen." I think that's how things used to be settled, that the power group was sufficiently homogeneous that it could overlook the other voices, and the pluralism of today simply is a more realistic portrayal. These are Protestants fighting Protestants in many cases, for example, and both of them could sign up for some of the same creeds, the same Bible, the same terms, but they've developed separate histories, and yes, it's hard to overcome those separate histories. What I don't think we dare do, as I hear you invoking Alasdair MacIntyre, I think he wrote a profound book after Virtue, a profound book on the bind we're in, but I haven't the faintest idea what to do with it on the last page, because in effect he simply says each community lives by its story and there's no potential for the overlappage of these stories. There's no point of their intersection. And that would then leave us with the situation of nothing but Lebanon. Now that is certainly the strongest trend in the world. Tribalisms, even on huge scales. Iran is simply the biggest example of it, in which people say, if we don't share all our terms, we don't even share common humanity, we don't share, you don't even belong in this space. But I think that's too despairing. I would have to say there are a lot of places where there can be persuasion. I can only say in my own case, I think that 20 years ago, I was a minister, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, I was a minister in ministry. Before it was legal, there were some times when I had an impulse to say, I think I'd counsel an abortion, just looking at the whole existential circumstance. And when Roe and Wade decision came along, I don't think I was deeply disturbed. And in the course of these years, all the way across from University of Chicago Aristotelian atheists to Orthodox Jews to Southern Baptists to Catholics have presented some arguments which persuade me to be far less ready for abortion. Now, there must be a lot of people like I that are somehow fluid and reached. I gave those illustrations to show there are four very different sets of assumptions by which people could reach me, even though I'm not quite any of the groups that reached me. Or another illustration, I was in Seattle last year, and I met with four denominational jurisdictions. Seattle is interesting because the Roman Catholic Archbishop is refusing to pay his defense taxes, and so everyone has to face this. And these four church body heads there said, well, when you leave, be sure you know this, that the line is not between those in our parish who are making their living in defense industries versus those who aren't. The line is within those two communities. It's not between those who are in the military installations near here, which are plentiful, and those who aren't, because there are military people on both sides of this and non-military. He said the line is drawn within those communities, and then he said, and also the line is drawn within the mind of an awful lot of the people who are there. We can go both ways on it. I have a hunch I was more of a unilateralist 2 years ago than now, as I find myself moving toward a kind of a minimal deterrence view by reading the Catholic bishops' document, even though they're not finally for minimal deterrence. I think we're more fluid than you picture, and I'm compelled by other people's stories because there are places where their stories and mine overlap or where their story is better than mine. And what happens that you're describing is when we give up on any possibility of sharing, that's when we dig in and say, religion should be a lot like the National Rifle Association. Produce 2 million letters tomorrow and Congress will quake and they'll go along. I think we see the limits of that. And the groups you mentioned didn't get a lot. The people who said we'll merely assert power without trying to persuade didn't get as far as the groups that set out to persuade. And I don't think that people are nearly as, if they're outside the New Christian Right camp, nearly as frightened by the possibility of their power as they were a couple of years ago when they thought they were more persuasive instead of just powerful. I agree with everything you said about how money talks, how power talks, but I don't believe we have to surrender quite so readily to saying that's the only instrument by which we can do our bartering.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with the third segment in a series of conversations about contemporary American religious thought and practice. The panelists were Marjorie Heyer of the Washington Post, Martin Marty of the University of Chicago, Harmon Smith of Duke University, Father James English of Raleigh, North Carolina, and Mark Taylor of Williams College. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.